Well, as we begin this morning, I'm going to do just a brief recap as we did last week. So for the past 2 weeks, we've been looking at this topic of biblical theology. And hopefully you've understood by this point that biblical theology is the discipline of reading the Bible as a grand story that finds its culmination in Christ. Well, last week, we began to dive into the redemptive story, and we began to look at how everything's being played out. And what we've understood is that God's plan of redemption has not occurred instantaneously, but instead it has been revealed progressively through a series of what?
Covenants.
Through a series of covenants. So things aren't happening this quick. They're going very slowly throughout time. And God is engaging. God is the one who is introducing these covenants. Now, what is a covenant? What do we say?
A promise between one or two or more people.
That's right. So it's a promise between one or two more or two people. Kings often do this. It can be kind of viewed as a treaty, right? So a greater king would initiate this covenant with a lesser king. And what would it include? Remember?
A sign of something.
There would be a sign, so a reminder of this covenant. All right, so it includes a sign. What else?
Like conditional, right?
Yes, there's conditions, right? That's right. You do this, then there will be blessings. You don't do this, there will be curses, right? And so as we started out, what we see about God in Genesis 1 is that not only is He creator, not only is He all-powerful as He creates all things simply with the sound of His voice, but He is a king. And as this greater king establishes a relationship with the crown jewel of His creation, that is man, He engages in a covenant. Now, is the word covenant found in Genesis 1 through 3?
No.
It's not. In fact, it's not even introduced until Genesis 9. However, if it looks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, chances are it is a duck, right? So we see that God, as He engages in this relationship, as He engages in a covenant with Adam, that He promises him two specific things. He promises to provide for him, and He promises to preserve him. How would He provide for him? What do we understand?
He provides food.
He provides a home for him, right? Where's the home? In the garden, which, remember, represents royalty in the ancient world. So this king is giving this lesser king a royal place to live, right? What else? What else does He provide him with? He provides him with a helper to ensure that he'll get the job done. He provides him with a job, right? You are to be fruitful, multiply, and exercise dominion over all things. So you are to rule. There's just one condition. What's the condition? Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And ultimately, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we understood, is the sign of this covenant. It is to let Adam know that though he is ruler, he is not supreme ruler. He is not God, right? And so he says, if you eat from this, what will happen? You'll die. And of course, when we got to Genesis 3, we understand that rather than willfully submit to what God has called them to do, instead, they choose to exalt themselves, to put themselves at the place of God. They choose to disobey. They commit cosmic treason. And at this point, the curses are initiated. Now, what is important to know is that we as 21st century believers, and really just humanity as a whole in the 21st century, are experiencing those curses even today. Well, what were some of the things that took place?
Some of the curses?
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Childbirth pain.
Oof, sorry, ladies. Childbirth pain, right? A painful reminder that as they enter into this world, that it's not what it was meant to be, right? There's going to be pain. There's going to be frustration. What else? Marital conflict. Yeah. The relationship between the husband and wife is going to be strained. If you ever find yourself in the heat of a battle with your spouse, it is because of the fall. My kids were roughhousing last night and got a little too carried away, and we found ourselves in a slight little heat of a battle because of this. Well, that's because of the fall, is what I say, not because of me. What else?
Weeds.
What's that?
Weeds,
thorns, and thistles. Work is going to be tough. Your struggles with your boss, your struggles in a mundane job, all of the difficulties you find when it comes to work, all those weeds as you're trying to do landscaping or whatever it is that's going on, is because of the fall. Anything else? Death. Sin and death are now ruling over this world. You know, it's interesting because we view God as creator. We know that he's all-powerful. We know that he is personal. And, of course, we know eventually that he's merciful. And we'll get to that in just a second. But even as he bestows mercy, right? Now, how does he bestow mercy? Well, what do we understand? He provides a covering for them, absolutely, right? So they are shamed, right? So we know that the relationship between God and man is now messed up as well. So there's shame, insecurities, there is this feeling of guilt before a holy God. So what does he do? They sow fig leaves on themselves. It's not enough. So God kills an animal and provides for them animal coverings or clothes to cover their shame, right? So God gives them something. God even promises in Genesis 3:15 that he's going to send one from Eve's line to fix everything, right? I mean, that's the first proclamation of the gospel. Remember that. Genesis 3:15 is the proto-evangelium. It is the first proclamation. One will come to fix it. But then when Genesis 4, Genesis 5, and Genesis 6 come, what you understand is that though God is merciful, sin and death still are victorious, at least at this point. You think about this. With Genesis chapter 5, you see here all together, Adam lived a total of 930 years, and then he died. You see it again in Genesis 5, verse 8. All together, Seth lived a total of 912 years, and then he died. It continues. All together, Enosh lived a total of 905 years, and then he died. This happens 8 different times in Genesis chapter 5. Letting us know that this was not what God intended, but instead this is what is taking place because of the fall. Now, after, of course, the issue with Cain and Abel, and after all these things take place, we know then that in Genesis 6, rather than things getting better, things get worse. And so God decides that like he banished Adam and Eve from the garden, he decides to banish all of humanity from the earth. But there's one family that God finds favor with. What is that family? Noah, right? Let me ask you this. Was Noah perfect? So Noah, honestly, if we're honest with ourselves, could have deserved to be wiped out in this flood as well, right? Yet because of God's gracious electing purposes, and because of the promise that he made in Genesis 3:15 to ensure that one would come from Eve's line, God keeps this family intact. He says, gather a whole bunch of animals 2 by 2, put them on an ark. And what we understand is just as he provides Adam and Eve with clothing to protect from shame, he provides for Noah and his family a wooden ark to protect from wrath, from his judgment. Constantly, God provided again and again and again. And then when you get to Genesis 9, after the flood subsides, of course, humanity is wiped out except for Noah and his family. They are placed in a new creation on dry ground. And what does God say in Genesis 9, verse 1 to Noah? Be fruitful and multiply. Just as he said it to Adam, he provides for him. He even ensures that there will be a sense of preservation because he says to Noah, never again will I destroy the world by water. So he says, here's what I provide. I give you food. I'm giving you the ability to exercise dominion. And you can't help but think to yourself, if you promise in Genesis 3 that one would come to fix things, you can't help but ask, is this the guy? Is this the one who will fix all things? Well, what we see at the end of chapter 9, verse 29, is that Noah lived a total of 950 years, and he dies. Yes?
How come in Genesis 5 with Enoch, it says that he walked with God, and he doesn't use that same verbiage?
Yeah, well, God took him from the earth, so he never actually dies. He doesn't experience death. This is one of the rare instances that we see this. We see it, of course, with Elijah as well. Hebrews 11 talks about this, that it's an issue of faith. So Enoch has some sort of faith, some sort of pursuit of God. Now, of course, the faith that he has is in promises that have yet to be fulfilled. But Enoch is seeking to walk with the Lord, and because of this, God honors him. Yeah. You see it with Enoch, you see it with Elijah. I think that's the only two that actually don't taste death. Does that kind of answer the question? See your wheels turning a little bit. Okay. All right, so at this point, Noah dies. Of course, his sons in Genesis 10 are responsible for pretty much filling the earth, establishing the nations. With chapter 11, as things continue, again, things don't get better, things get worse, because now, rather than fill out the entire earth as God has called them to do, they decide to stop. They decide to make a name for themselves. They decide to exalt themselves to the level of God, just as Adam and Eve did, just as humanity did in Genesis 6. And God sees this as they seek to build this tower called Babel. And what happens? He confuses the language. He separates, he distances people from themselves. So now there's not even a camaraderie among humanity. Now everyone is separate. Now people can't understand one another. And you can't help but ask the question, what about the promise? What about Genesis 3:15? When is this going to happen? I mean, if you're talking about 900 years here, 900 there, 9 and 9, it just keeps on going. Like, this is a long period of time, right? This isn't just like a couple of days. So you're asking, what happens to the promise? Well, then Genesis 12 comes in. And really, it happens at the end of Genesis 11. As they're going through these genealogies, if you have your Bibles, I invite you to turn there, because we're going to kind of look at all of these scriptures. We're going to bounce around a little bit this morning. Genesis 11, you hear that there is this man by the name of Terah who has three sons, and one of those sons' name is Abram. Now, Terah is not, as far as we know, a follower of God. Terah, according to Joshua 24, is an idol maker. They come from this land called Ur, where there is no evidence whatsoever that these people have ever pursued God. And yet, something happens in Genesis chapter 12. Now, here's what we understand. Starting in Genesis 12, although sin and destruction have been the overall themes from Genesis 4 through 11, with Genesis 12, we see a reversal of the curse. As God says to Abram, from you all the nations of the earth, not will they be judged, but instead, what does it say? They will be blessed. Now something changes. But you think about this. I mean, let's follow the rabbit just for a second. I mean, God shows up, and this is what he says in Genesis chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. It says, now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. Where am I at here? And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Understand this. God doesn't choose Abram to be the representative of this covenant because he's righteous or because he's more talented than the person beside him. Instead, it's simply due, again, to the gracious, electing purposes of God. We see this theme coming out time and time again, even in the first 12 chapters of Genesis, that God is the one providing redemption, that God does not have to do this, that instead of bestowing full-fledged wrath and nothing but wrath, God bestows mercy, God bestows grace. He looks down into creation, he sees this man Abram, who there is no evidence of him pursuing God, and yet God pursues him. Is that not our story? That we have, yes sir?
In a few places in here, it kind of suggests, like, with Noah, it says Noah's sacrifice caused God to do something. Like, there's a few places in here where it seems like it's insinuating that the person is causing God to act by it being God's electing purpose.
Yeah, and we're actually going to talk about that here in just a second, how we're going to see these... No, you're good. The subtle instances of sacrifices that are made. Because what is man trying to do? Man is attempting to be made right with God somehow. And we're going to look at that here in just a second. However, does God have to accept a sacrifice? No. But instead, God is allowed. Now, why do they do this? This was a question that was actually asked to me this past week. And not to stay too long on the subject, but if we think about this for a second, you think about Cain and Abel. Why in the world would they do a sacrifice? Why would they bring an offering? There is no call. There is no command to do this. Well, who kills the first animal and provides a covering? God. They're seeking to emulate God. They're seeking somehow to be made right with God. Now, Abel seeks to do that, but not Cain. And we're going to look at that here in just a second. So, does God have to do this? No. But they're seeking to emulate. So, I mean, even if we think about Romans 1, that those who've never heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they've never heard the law, but yet the things they do, they make it a law unto themselves. What are we seeing here? That there is some sort of desire and understanding that there is a God, and that we should seek to be made right with that God. The question is, are we pursuing the right God? Well, that only happens when God pursues us. All right, and we'll look at this and we'll see how this theme is played out. But this happens with Abram simply because of God's electing purposes. Abram does nothing. We don't see Abram at this point making a sacrifice. We don't see Abram calling out to God. We see his father being an idol maker, and yet God chooses Abram and says, you are to go. Now let's think about, this is a covenant that's established, and let's think about the covenant. Beginning with Genesis 12, verses 1 through 30, we find God engaging in a covenant relationship with Abram, where God promises Abram three things. Abram will be made into a great nation. We see, number two, Abram will be blessed, and his name will be made great. Number three, we see from Abram, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So there's three things that God has promised to Abram. Great nation, so you're going to have a place. Your name is going to be great. You yourself will be blessed. So he's going to experience some sort of prosperity. And from all the families of the earth, they will be blessed. So, I mean, this is going to affect everyone. This is tying directly into Genesis 3:15. If all the nations of the earth will be blessed, then what we understand is that they're going to be blessed. How? Through the arrival of one who will come from the seed of Abram, from this specific nation, which we will know will eventually be Israel, and all the families of the earth will be blessed because people from every tribe, tongue, and nation will be able to call upon the name of Jesus Christ. We're seeing how all of these little subtle things here are pointing to something greater. Again, we're seeing the grand story that finds its culmination in Christ. Now, this also includes a command. There is a command for him to go. Right? So you are to leave your place and go to the land that I will show you. We see yet again that there are blessings, but we also see that there is a curse. But this one's a little bit different because God says, him who dishonors you, I will curse. So it's not, well, if you remain faithful, then I will, or if you don't remain faithful, I will curse you. Instead, it's those who are not faithful to you, those who dishonor you, I'm going to curse. And we're going to see how this is played out here in just a second with Genesis 15. So there's a command, there's blessings, there's curses. Last week I had mentioned, Graham Goldsworthy had said that the Bible can be summarized in eight words. Remember, there's eight words. God's people, in God's place, under God's rule. Think about this for a second. The people, if we're talking about this covenant given specifically to Abram, the people are going to be the descendants of Abram. The place is going to be the land that is called Canaan. And these people are going to be different. Why? Because they're going to submit themselves under God's rule. So now the focus is really not necessarily anymore on humanity itself, but on a specific place. We're going to see that here in a second. Any questions on this yet? Leading up to this so far, anything? All right. So, of course, this promise is given. Abraham's like, all right, cool. I agree. Now, if I say Abraham, just know I'm speaking of Abram at this point. Of course, his name hasn't changed yet. Because I trust you. Sounds good. Things, they continue to, they leave. He obeys. He hops up on a donkey. They all go. And in Genesis 13, you've got Lot, his nephew, who looks out and he's like, look, we're just way too big. We need to separate. And so Lot goes, well, I tell you what, that land that's pretty much flowing with milk and honey, that beautiful pasture, I'll take that and you can just have the rest. Abraham goes, cool, sounds good. Genesis 14, of course, we know that with Lot, things don't go according to plan. And so Abram ends up delivering Lot. We have, of course, at this point, a priest by the name of Melchizedek that blesses Abram from Salem, which is eventually this place known as Jerusalem. All this will eventually tie in. But then in Genesis 15, Abram begins to think. So some years have passed by, and he begins to go, man, what about that promise that God had made? What about this promise that he had made to me? How is this going to happen? I'm getting much older. I have no children of my own. I only have this servant boy by the name of Eleazar. Maybe that will be the one. And then God shows up. By Genesis 15, Abram becomes curious as to how God will fulfill these promises since his wife Sarah is barren. Well, Genesis 15, beginning in verse 4, it says this, behold, the word of the Lord came to him. He says, this man, speaking of Eleazar, shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside, and he said, look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them. And then he said, so shall your offspring be. Now, look at verse 6. This is a big one. Verse 6. And Abram believed the Lord, and God, or the Lord, counted it or credited it to him as what? Righteousness. What is it that gives Abram righteousness? Belief. Nothing else but belief. So prior to this, he's unrighteous. He finds himself pretty much under condemnation if we're thinking about him being a sinful human being. But because he trusts in a promise that is yet to be fulfilled, God it puts into or deposits into his spiritual bank account righteousness. Not his own righteousness, but God's very righteousness. He credits to him. He says, this is who you are now. So the issue here has to do specifically with belief. Now I want you to think about this for a second. With a simple reminder from God, Abram trusted the Lord's plan, and as a result, it's credited to him as righteousness. The righteousness given to Abram was not based on anything God or Abram could have done himself, but instead was based on what God would do for Abram. So it's nothing that he's able to do on his own. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound familiar for our own life when it comes to the gospel? Of course it does. We're seeing how it's played out here very early in the redemptive storyline. To be righteous means to be blameless before God. So, here's what's important to understand. From Genesis 1 all the way to Genesis 15 at this point, it's like Adam and Eve were covered with animal skins to protect them from shame, like Noah and his family are covered with a wooden ark to protect them from the wrath of God. Now, Abram would be covered with the very righteousness of God to protect him from condemnation. Constant provision made by God. Constant redemption supplied by God. And this issue having to do with faith is peppered throughout Scripture. We see it primarily in Hebrews 11 as the author seeks to point us back to the beginning of creation. Look at this. Everybody got this?
No?
Good? Everybody good? Look at this here. Now, this isn't in your notes. I was just doing this week, and it was like, man, this is so good. You got to see this. Hebrews 11, verse 4. This kind of alludes to, brother, what you were talking about. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. What is it that makes God approve Abel's offering? Faith. Right? By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. So it is a trust, it is a belief in something that he can't do on his own, but instead something that God does. And he's commended as righteous for this. So for the issue for Cain is not that Cain, well, Cain gave fruit instead of the fat portions. No, the issue is faith. The issue is belief. We see this yet again with Noah, Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. What is consistent with both of these? What gives them righteousness?
Faith.
And we see it yet again with Abram. What gives us righteousness? Faith. Trust and believe that we cannot come to God on our own, that nothing we do on our own will be sufficient for him, but instead we trust in the completed work of Jesus Christ.
What gives them faith?
What gives them faith? Well, clearly they have...
In this situation, I mean, I understand New Covenant, but in these cases, they're in total, you know, sin at
right.
that point. Where are they getting faith from?
So this kind of brings up the issue of how are Old Testament saints saved? Or could they even be saved, right? Because prior to Christ, if they're completely sinned, they're bound by law. Like, how can they do this? Well, for them, it's really been consistent, whether it's in the Old Covenant or the New Covenant, because faith is the issue. Faith in what? For them, it's faith in promises that have yet to be fulfilled. For us, it is faith in promises that have been revealed. Does that make sense? So what Abel has faith in is that based on what, of course, his mother and father taught him, I mean, he understands that that God provided for them some sort of offering where he kills these animals, provides for them a covering. He takes this, he goes, man, I'm going to do the same thing, seeking to find some sort of favor with God. Now, is he flawless? No, he's a sinner. But he has faith that God, what he promised in Genesis 3:15 in bestowing mercy, that one was going to come to fix things. And he seeks to make himself right with God. He trusts in God. It's not because of anything he does on his own, but it's because he trusts in a promise, a very subtle promise in Genesis 3:15. Noah has faith in something that God has told him, right? So we see it with Abram as well. He has faith in what God has told him. So what is the overall theme when it comes to salvation, whether it's the Old Testament or New Testament? Faith. Faith in what is yet to be fulfilled. For us, it's faith in what has been revealed. Does that make sense?
It does.
Sure.
It's hard to reconcile how they come to faith if they're in a state of total rebellion.
I don't know that they're all in total rebellion, because if they're holding to God's going to do what he says he's going to do, well, I don't know.
Well, we know that when it comes from a judicial standpoint, I mean, absolutely, they find themselves completely at odds with God, right? They are sinners who really the only thing they deserve is death. But we also know that God has extended common grace to everyone, to where we're not as bad as we have to be, right? And God has revealed to us, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, to where at some point we see, okay, there is a God. So for these people, although they have not seen that it's Jesus Christ, they're trusting that there is a God. They are trusting in the fact that he has promised. I mean, because this has been handed down, of course, orally at this point. Nothing's written. But they're trusting that God would send one to fix things. They don't know how that's going to be played out. But they're seeking to trust what God has said is truly going to happen. And God credits them as righteousness. How that's fully played out, I can't give you a sealed, locked, perfect, cut and dry answer. But what we know is consistent from the Old Testament to the New is it's an issue of faith. And it's not a faith in themselves, it's a faith in what God can do. Does that make sense? Alright, so let's keep going here for just a second. So with the end of Genesis 15, God seals the covenant. So at this point, what basically happens is he's promised that his offspring is going to be great. He's promised that he is going to truly keep the promise that he made back in Genesis 12. At that point, God says with the end of Genesis 15, if you look there, you can see it in your scriptures. He says, look, I want you to get a whole bunch of animals. I want you to cut them down the middle. I want you to put some, the one side on this side, the left side. I want you to put some on the right side. And then he makes Abram fall into a deep sleep. And at this point, we see that a theophany takes place. A theophany is basically God seeking to reveal himself in a way that humans can understand. He appears as a smoking pot, right? He appears as a flaming torch. And what does he do? He walks through these animals that have been split. What we're seeing here is that as God seals the covenant, he's pronouncing judgment upon himself. This is what people would do whenever they would enter into a covenant. This is what kings would do. They would make some sort of offering. They'd walk through the pieces that were cut and they'd say, listen, if I don't keep my end of the deal, then I deserve to be cut in half. I deserve to be destroyed. So what God is saying here is, listen, if I don't keep my end of the bargain, if I don't actually do what I've promised to do, back from Genesis 3:15 all the way now to Genesis 15, then may the infinite, holy God, who has no beginning and no end, cease to exist. It's God speaking here. So what we see is that the covenant with Abraham is not contingent upon Abram keeping it, but instead God keeping it. God says, this will happen. This is how the redemptive story will take place. And if it doesn't, then may I myself be destroyed.
Because he doesn't make Abram walk through it, right?
No.
Which is very unusual.
Very unusual. It's the same whenever he talks about in Genesis 12 that he'll curse those who dishonor him. Right? God is saying here, listen, I'm going to wipe myself off of all existence if I don't keep my end of the deal. Don't worry about you. Which seems kind of crazy to us. God says this is going to be solely contingent upon whether or not I keep it. So, we see this here with Genesis 17. The sign of the covenant is given. The sign of the covenant is circumcision.
Which I will never understand. I'm like, why?
I'm sure they had trouble understanding it too at this point. So God says, listen, you know, so you think about the Adamic covenant, the sign is what? With the covenant with Adam and Eve? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The sign for Noah is what? Now the sign for Abraham is circumcision, showing you're going to be set apart. You're going to be distinct from the rest of the world. You're going to be different. That's, of course, not based on anything that you have done, Abram, but based on everything that I have done. The people who will come from you, the nation that will come from you, all the families of the earth who will be blessed by you will be different. And the sign of this covenant, trusting in this, is circumcision. At this point, new names are given, revealing that they've received new identities. That God has now given them a new task. New responsibility. Just as God names Adam, calls him man, and gives him the task of exercising dominion, God gives Abram a new identity, and he says this to Abram. He says, no longer will you be Abram, you'll be Abraham. Abram meant exalted father. Abraham means father of many. So I'm keeping my end of the deal. This, of course, demonstrates that Abram would be the father of many nations and kings. Of course, while Sarai meant princess, Sarah meant my princess, demonstrating that she'd be the mother of many nations and kings. That many would call her. So it's interesting how it's kings and queens again. Princesses, these type of things, right? Just as we saw from the beginning of Genesis 1. Creating man in his image, giving him the responsibility of exercising dominion, of being a king. God does it yet again. He does it with Noah as he says, be fruitful, multiply, exercise, rule. And now he's saying it yet again. This issue with the kingdom of God and royalty just keeps popping up over and over again. Now, let's see kind of at this point how the story has begun to progressively unfold. Whereas the Adamic and Noahic covenants consist of commands, the Abrahamic covenant now consists of promises. So God commands Adam to adhere to the covenant given to him in Genesis 2. But with Abraham, God promises Abraham that God himself would adhere to the covenant. So things are beginning to build. God commands Noah to fulfill the creational mandate by being fruitful and multiplying in Genesis 9. But what we see in Genesis 12 is that God promises Abraham that he would be fruitful and from him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And whereas the Adamic and Noahic covenants dealt with the world as a whole, the Abrahamic covenant was fulfilled through a specific nation and place. Now, does it affect the world as a whole? Sure. But now, rather than simply zero in on the world as a whole, think about it. He makes the Garden of Eden, with his image bearers acting as king and queen. He gives them the responsibility to rule. They're to fill the entire earth. This is all, every person on the earth at that point was meant to be a representative of God. Of course, the fall takes place. So now what happens? Rather than focusing on the Garden of Eden expanding throughout the world, now it's focusing on Israel. Could the world, could other nations come into a covenant blessing with Israel and God? Sure. But they had to become like the Israelites, right? They had to go to Israel. At least at this point. So now it's not focused on the Garden of Eden expanding throughout the entire world. Now it's focused on this specific nation among a whole bunch of other nations. And that nation is Israel. People are circumcised. They're different. Why? Because they're called to be the representatives of God now. Not the whole world. Israel. And if the world wanted to be a representative of God, what would they do? They'd go to Israel. You see? Is it making sense? All right. So things seem to be going pretty well at this point. Of course, a lot happens pretty much from Genesis 15 all the way to 22. Of course, in Genesis 16, we've got Sarah who seeks to take things into her own hands. And she goes, look, I'm just way too old. So here's my young slave woman by the name of Hagar who can give you a child. Of course, Ishmael is born. As Abram is having a conversation with God, he goes, can we use Ishmael? What's God saying? No, not Ishmael. We're going to use your own son, right? So, of course, then the son is born. His name is Isaac. What does Isaac mean? You remember? What? Yeah. Because they're just like totally like taken back by the fact that like a 100-year-old dude can have a kid. And then he laughs about this. Like, I love the story because Sarah laughs as well. Right? And God says to Sarah, "You were laughing." And she's like, "No, I wasn't." He's like, "Yeah, you were." Isaac is born. The stage seems to be set. So you recognize, okay, so it may not be Abraham who will be the one to fulfill what Genesis 3:15 says, but now Isaac is here, the one who's been promised for so many chapters. And then this happens. Genesis 22. God appears to Abraham, and he says to him, "Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." And this is what's amazing to me. No real full-fledged interaction between Abraham and God at this point. Verse 3 simply says, early the next morning, Abraham gets up and he loads his donkey. And he takes his kid with him. And he goes to do the very thing that God has called him to do. What we see here is that the offering of Isaac in Genesis 22 is extraordinary. Because Abraham was called to sacrifice the heir on whom the blessing to the world itself depended. This is how God was going to bring the one he promised in Genesis 3:15 through his line. And now all of a sudden, you've got God saying, "Kill him." You can't help but wonder, well, what about that whole... Like, I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking, all right, is God about to, like, implode? Is he about to be destroyed? Because he's about to break the promise that he just gave to me. Right? And so what we see here really on Abraham's part is that God's command for Abraham to sacrifice Isaac was a test that demonstrated faith in action. So Abraham believing God and God crediting it to him as righteousness shows us here that it's not just, okay, empty belief. Yeah, that's cool. I believe it. But instead, it's faith that has evidence of works, right? So, of course, the works aren't what saves the individual. Works are the evidence of a person who has been saved. So we're seeing faith in action. Matthew Henry says it this way: "The best evidence of our fearing God is our being willing to serve, or is our being willing to serve and honor Him with that which is dearest to us." What is dearest to you? And this is the issue with Jesus with the rich young ruler, right? What do I do to inherit eternal life? Well, keep the law. Man, I've kept it. I've kept every bit of it. Cool. Sell all your stuff and give it to the poor. And what does he do? He walks away sad. Why? Because the thing that's dearest to him is not Christ. It's instead it's his riches. The thing that is dearest to Abraham, what we're seeing, is not Isaac, but instead is God. Which is what all of us are called to do, right? That all of us put to the side all the material blessings, children, financial security, jobs, all of those things should be put to the side, and our primary focus is upon God. So we're seeing here faith in action. Now, of course, we know the rest of the story. If you have your Bibles, you can turn there. It's Genesis chapter 22. When we get to Genesis 22, verse 9, it says this: "When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand. He took the knife to slaughter his son." I mean, get this. He's like, it's up in the air, getting ready to thrust it in the child that has been given to him by God. And then verse 11 says, "But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, 'Abraham, Abraham.' And Abraham said, 'Here I am.' And he says, 'Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Now, listen to verses 13 and 14. I love this. "And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his thorns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. And so Abraham called the name of that place, 'The Lord will provide.'" There is so much to this story that we're seeing. But I want you to see the progression really quick. So the sacrifice of an animal in Genesis 3 reveals that there's some sort of link between sin and death. Why does God have to kill the animal? Because Adam and Eve messed up. God gives them provision, not because he's obligated to, but because he wants to, because he bestows mercy upon them. This is a good thing. So there's some sort of link at this point with a sacrifice to sin and death, but we're really not sure what it is. As the story continues, by the time we get to Genesis 4, the sacrifice made by Abel reveals one's allegiance before the king, right? He's got faith. He trusts in this ultimate supreme king. So the sacrifice relates to sin and death. The sacrifice, as we get to 4, begins to show one's allegiance before the king versus one's allegiance for themselves. As it continues here, we see the sacrifice made by Noah in Genesis 8 reveals that the act is pleasing to the Lord. Listen, people can make sacrifices all they want. God could have sat there and said, I couldn't care less what you do. And yet what we see with Genesis 8 is that it's actually pleasing. And Noah makes his sacrifice on a new creation, showing that his allegiance will be to God. Showing, ultimately, what we see here as well, and it's now fleshed out with Abraham in Genesis 22, that God is cool with accepting a substitute. I mean, really what Noah is demonstrating in Genesis 8 is, listen, really it should be me who's being killed, but instead it's pleasing for me to allow something else to be killed in my place. God killing an animal and giving them these animal skins to cover them, I mean, really, you want to wipe out their shame? Wipe them out. But instead, something else is wiped out in their place. So what we're seeing now in Genesis 22, now it's beginning to open up even more, is that God accepts a substitute. The Lord provides something else to die in order to take the place of the one who really should have died. I mean, because of even Abraham and Isaac's sin, really both of them should have died. But God gives a substitute. And we're going to see how that's played out all the more when we get to the Mosaic Covenant. Why the substitute is so important. What the substitute represents. But do you see how it's building? How just this little subtle instance of a sacrifice then shows that there's something related to allegiance, then shows that it's actually pleasing to the Lord, and now, based on that sacrifice, that it doesn't just have to be any old someone, it can actually be a substitute. Now, of course, we're going to see with the law that it's got to be a specific substitute. But man, this is incredible. Because if we're thinking about this story for us, who's the substitute? Christ. And what's amazing about Christ, and the really the parallel that we see here with Abraham, is that God the Father gives his son as a sacrifice, and rather than stop it at the moment that he's put on a cross, God allows it to take place. And based on his death and resurrection, when we have faith in the completed work of Christ, what happens? It's credited to us as righteousness because we trusted in the ultimate substitute that became our sacrifice and redemption. That's so good. You see how it's good here. That the righteousness we receive is not any righteousness of our own, but instead righteousness that's given to us directly from God. He clothes us with this, just as he clothed Adam and Eve with animal skins, just as he clothed Noah in this ark. Now he clothes us with righteousness, protecting us from condemnation. All of this is just little subtle instances that will ultimately be realized with Christ. You see how it's a grand story that finds its culmination in Jesus. All right, we're almost done here. Three more slides. So, going super quick. We're not going to hone in on this. Of course, Isaac is spared. Isaac eventually has two sons, Jacob and Esau. What's interesting about this story is that there's a call for the older, that is Esau, to serve the younger. It's found in Genesis 25. Again, here's the theme. It is a demonstration of God's electing purposes prevailing over the traditions of the world. Right? We know the story. We hear it from Malachi 1, even Romans 9. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. A question was asked once, what does it mean for God to say that he hates? Does he actually like hate him? Like hate him? Or is this something different? No, this is in relation to how God is going to use both of these. I mean, let's think about it. Both of these people are going to ultimately bring about nations, right? So what does God say? Well, God chooses to provide. So it's kind of like a preference. God chooses for the promise to be fulfilled through Jacob, through the nation of Israel. Esau is eventually those who make up the Edomites. God blesses the Edomites at a certain point at the beginning, but God does not use them to bring about the promised Messiah. from Genesis 3:15. So it's kind of like when Jesus says, if you don't hate your mother and father. So it's not like you actually hate your mother and father. No, the preference should be, or we prefer God. We put God at a higher priority than we do our parents. So it's the same thing here. So it's not like he actually hates Esau. He actually blesses Esau. But the younger ends up having precedence over the older. Just as Abram was renamed Abraham to bring about a new identity, Jacob's renamed. Genesis 32, Jacob, of course, meant deceiver. We probably know that story. Jacob's a bad dude. If you ever read the story of Jacob, he's kind of a bad guy. But his name changes to Israel, meaning one who wrestles with God. And really, the renaming of Jacob is not only a testimony of Jacob's own life, but it will be the eventual testimony of the nation of Israel. Nevertheless, even Israel will wrestle with God, God's sovereign purposes will prevail. Last thing here, story continues. Of course, Jacob has 12 sons, which will eventually make up the 12 tribes of Israel. But with the 12 sons and the pilgrimage to Egypt, right? We know the story of Joseph. What we actually see with this story is a fulfillment of Genesis 12. This is a fulfillment of God saying, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Your descendants will be as numerous as the stars of the sky, as the sand on the sea. I mean, you think about this for a couple of reasons. So this awful thing happens with Joseph, but if that didn't happen, right, they would have been killed in this awful famine. But instead, they find themselves in Egypt. Why? Pure luck? No. God's sovereignty is being displayed here. God orchestrating a plan. And what's interesting is with Genesis 12, and ultimately even Joseph taking the head position in Genesis 50, this is a fulfillment because in Exodus 1 verses 6 through 7 it says, then Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation, but the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. This is a fulfillment right here. Now it's not the total fulfillment yet, but it's a fulfillment. We got to understand here, reading Exodus 1, 6 through 7, readers of the Bible have to understand that God's promises always come true. That God has promised that Abram would be made great. He'd be made into a great nation. His descendants would be as numerous as the stars of the sky. And now they are. And this will get to the point where it poses a threat for Pharaoh when we dive into the Mosaic Covenant. So let's finish with this really quick. Based on everything we've understood so far, so what? Like, that was so long ago. Who cares? How does this apply to us? Well, although God engages in covenants with specific people, all of these covenants affect humanity as a whole. Michelle, is that the right way to spell affect? You're my literature person. Yes. All right. The story of Abraham would eventually become our story. And here's how we see it. The last slide. Through Abraham, God was preaching that salvation is by grace alone. That Abraham did nothing to deserve to be pursued by God, and yet God chooses to pursue him anyways. That's our story. And through Abraham, God was preaching salvation is through faith alone. Saved by grace, through faith. Not a faith that we can do enough or come from the right family. Abraham did not come from the right family. Abraham's dad was an idol maker again, and yet he trusts in what God has promised. And salvation is bestowed. Through Abraham, God was preaching that salvation would be accomplished through a substitute. That it wouldn't have to be our death, but instead it would eventually be the death of his own son. Through Abraham, God was preaching that salvation would result in circumcision of the heart, that we'd be distinct, that we'd be set apart, that our lives would be different. And that our different lives wouldn't be the things that actually bring us salvation, but it would be the evidence that we've received salvation. Through Abraham, God was preaching that salvation, because all the nations of the earth would be blessed, would extend to all of humanity. People from every tribe and tongue and nation would eventually come. So as we close, I want you to think about, really quick, the couple of verses that I read from Hebrews letting us know that this issue was faith. For the Old Testament saints, it was faith in something that had yet to be fulfilled. And we're about to see how this has played out. I would encourage you this afternoon to read Hebrews 11 all the way through as he just goes down the list, starting with Abel all the way down basically to the end of the prophets before the arrival of Christ. And he talks about Moses, he talks about Gideon, he talks about Samson and David and all these people. And at the end it says this. He says, for this is Hebrews 11 verse 39. All of these people, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. None of these people did. Verse 40, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. Therefore, this is Hebrews 12, verse 1, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, speaking of all those who had faith before us, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Look at this, verse 2, or listen to this. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Ah, the perfecter is not found in what we see ultimately with Abraham and Isaac. The perfecter is not found with Noah. It's not found with Adam. It is found in Christ. And though we often will say, man, I just wish that I could live in a time like this where I could see God's mighty works and all the evidences of the things that took place. All these people had faith in things that had not been fulfilled. We're on the other side where we actually have experienced and we see the things that have been revealed. We're in a better place. Because we can put our trust not in a promise where we're not really sure how this is going to play out. But we just, yeah, we'll believe you. Instead, we put our trust in the author and finisher of our faith, Jesus Christ. You see how it all points? All right. Any questions?